Hi, this is Geographical Imaginations. Welcome to this month's radio expedition into the geographies of everything and nothing. I'm the host and producer, Kevin S. Fox, coming to you from Studio B at Radio Fabrique in Salzburg, Austria. Tonight, we start with a definition, and here we go. Psychogeography, noun. The study of the precise laws and specific effects of the geographical environment, consciously organized or not, on the emotions and behavior of the individuals. This comes from French Guy Debord. We speak tonight with Dr. Tina Richardson on the phone from England to learn, well, quite a bit more about psychogeographical histories and practices. Stay tuned to what we call Psychogeography 101. Welcome to Season 3. If you've listened before, you'll notice a change. We now use a different song throughout the show, during the intro, and also then during the show IDs. It's called Sand Dune. We continue to work with and use Mike Allen's music, as we feel like it matches the mood of the show. Tonight, though, yes, we do kick off the new season with a discussion of what might very well be a fundamental part of this show and of the concept, the geographical imagination. It's this relationship between the self and the environment. And we explore a little bit avant-garde and maybe not so avant-garde approaches to understanding and then maybe remapping the environment or ambiances around us in the urban. And while this might not be new to some of you, especially if you're one to go out and explore the city, psychogeography has been seen as a critique of the city as a spectacle and a reworking of our own mental maps of the spaces we inhabit. So tonight, we join Tina Richardson, as I said, from Leeds in England. Dr. Richardson specializes in the field of urban cultural studies and is a practicing psychogeographer. In 2015, she edited the volume Walking Inside Out, Contemporary British Psychogeography. She currently maintains Particulations, a blog on psychogeography, regularly speaks and consults on urban environments, co-edits a new zine on psychogeography called Steps, and was founder of the Leeds Psychogeography Group.
Psychogeography is usually, not always, but mostly attributed to a group of activists who were around, mostly in Paris, but in Europe in general, from 1957 to the early 70s, and they were called the Situationist International. And they are credited with inventing psychogeography, which in its most broad sense is really kind of critical forms of urban walking. But the Situationists, or as lots of people call them, the SI, or the Situationist Internationale, they created a form of walking that critiqued the sort of modernist city, Paris in particular, kind of post-war, and how it had kind of developed in the sort of early part of the 20th century mostly, and was becoming, to them, something they didn't like. They didn't have any investment in the place. They didn't think it was good for the everyday life of the people living there. And they decided to create a way of walking around Paris that enabled them to critique what they called the spectacle, which was the image that kind of capitalism presents to those who live in the city. And they did that by doing what they would call chance walks, or what they called the dérive. D-E-R-I-V-E, or drift. And so they were kind of random walks that they kind of created maps from. And the walks were done by chance. They might, for example, take the outline of another European city and draw that outline on a map of Paris and walk around that line in Paris. So they would do interesting things like that challenged the way you walked in urban space, in particular in cities, so that you would walk a different route. So you would look at the city in a different way, because you wouldn't be walking those regular routes that you walk to, say, from home to work, and where you stop eventually seeing what the city looks like, because it becomes, you become so used to it, you don't see it anymore. So really, they are attributed with the term psychogeography, although it has been used by other people in sort of slightly different ways as well. But that's who we think about when we think of the origins of psychogeography.
So, I mean, are they critiquing, so Paris then, I mean, in the 20th century and certainly post-war, the boulevards get wider, the urban plan is shifting. So the planners are sort of dictating a little bit more, inscribing more on the landscape, how it looks, and then really kind of how it feels to the people walking there. If you make a road wider, it's going to change the feel of walking through that space. Are they critiquing that? Or are they saying, well, we might not be sitting in an office making the plans for the new city, but we want to sort of inscribe ourselves in the city by walking into it, walking through
it? That's exactly what they were doing. Yeah. They were trying to write themselves into the city. They were trying to challenge the way that the city was kind of made and was set out for them by the urban planners, indeed. And they were saying, this is our city and we're going to rewrite it. And we're going to rewrite it based on how it makes us feel. So it was all tied up with very, very personal sort of feelings about the city, kind of emotionally how you felt. So it was about your subjectivity. The term that's quite often used is affect. Mm-hmm. So this is literally how it made you feel in a very personal way. So if you were on a walk, say, around Paris with a group of other people, you would be feeling differently about it than the next person. So it was very good in terms of allowing everybody to have a voice, or everybody, shall I say, who was involved in the walk, had a voice in terms of being able to express what they felt about a particular place. And they would attribute not random names exactly, but their own sort of names to places. They would call them quarters, and they would say this is a happy quarter because it made them feel a certain way. It might be based on the fact that there was a predominant colour. They kind of quite liked yellow. So yellow might be a predominant colour in a particular area, and they would call it the happy quarter. But they had lots of disparaging sort of names as well for places they didn't like, and quite often they would cut those areas out of the map. So they would take a map of Paris and cut out the areas they didn't like, areas that they said represented the spectacle. So there would be areas that were dominated by power in some way. And they would keep the areas they liked, and they'd kind of make a new map out of the original map.
Hmm. And so this, I guess the mapping part of it, is this documentation of their walks? Is it a proposal for a different way of thinking about the city, or both?
Yeah, it was both. They created the maps. They're quite easy to find online. Actually, they're kind of quite beautiful. Really, they look a little bit older than even sort of like the latter part of the 20th century. They do look quite sort of retro. But what they were trying to do was say this is how we feel about it. But they were also, part of their project was to propose what they called unitary urbanism, which was literally a new planning of the city. So they had, so part of the group, they had activists and painters and writers and architects. So part of their project, which kind of led on from the kind of psychogeography, you know, the walking part of it, was to propose a new kind of utopian space. So they had beautiful kind of architectural drawings of this, what they said was unitary urbanism, this kind of new project they proposed. And they're quite beautiful drawings as well. So that was all part of it, and that kind of led on from the walks themselves.
You You're listening to Geographical Imaginations, radio expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. For more information about the show, check out the website at www.geographicalimaginations.org. Do you have an idea for an episode or want to give some feedback? Go to the comments section on the website or to the blog and enter into the conversation. Now let's get back to our expedition. Also, then, their influence on academia. I'm thinking of Henri Lefebvre, for instance. I mean, some of his theoretical foundations, or his, you know, his production of space theory that is so huge in social sciences, probably broadly, but human geography specifically. I mean, it's influenced the whole next generation of scholars in the field of geography, at least in the Anglo-European, sort of American and European academy. I mean, his work itself is kind of informed by the situationist.
Yes, and he was a situationist. I don't think he was one for very long, and it's quite likely that Guy Debord, one of the founders of the Situationists, probably did sack him at some point, but because he fell out with almost everybody at some point or another. But Lefebvre's work is really, like you said, is a really good way of situating kind of psychogeography within geography, because, like you said, it's about the production of space. It's about it's a good crossover actually between cultural studies and geography as well. Cultural studies being my field, because it's about. It's about social, it's about our everyday experiences in space, it's about abstract space and all those kinds of things that are important to cultural theorists. So his time with the Situationists must have informed that on some level in order for him to be able to express so well how space is produced and how it produces us, you know. So which is kind of what psychogeography is sort of about ultimately, if I wanted to put it into like a little nutshell. It's a reciprocal relationship that we have as human beings with the space. You know, we produce the space and it retrospectively kind of produces us. Those two things aren't separate. To think that we are separate from space, you know, we see space as being sort of an inanimate thing and ourselves as being human and alive, and as if those two things aren't connected to each other, you know, which is what psychogeography was is, and some of the situation is just trying to kind of recreate that kind of connection so that we aren't sort of nomadic, you know, we're not separate from the space, we're kind of part of it. It's part of how we think about ourselves, indeed, you know. So
which is probably part of the reason why once encountering this the so-called spectacle, it, you know, it brought on this critique from the Situationists, because if, like you're saying, there is this reciprocal sort of relationship, or dare I say sort of a mirroring, which is a little bit of a different kind of relationship, but that if you are navigating Paris in the mid-20th century and in the feedback you're getting, the reciprocation that you're getting is this spectacle, you most certainly want to critique it, right? Because you're seeking out a different kind of experience from your urban space.
Yes. And this critiquing, what it did was, it, especially when they were kind of introducing new people to the group, it kind of made them think about that space in a different way. It kind of made them, but I think the mirror is a perfect kind of example of it, actually. Because it reflected back on the walker, For example, you know, taking a different route through space makes you look at something for the first time, and then you, as you look at that thing, you can't but not question yourself as you're questioning why that thing appears to be the way it is. You know, you're sort of questioning yourself as a citizen of that city, for example. So all those things kind of come up in this kind of critique of the spectacle.
Right, and what kind of citizen you are in that city, yeah.
Yeah,
What kind of citizen you are expected to be or limited to be.
And this kind of taken for granted, unquestioning way that one can walk through the city without realizing that you're doing that. You know, we all do that unless we choose to not do that for some reason.
Right.
You know, it's a natural way of walking through the city, especially a city that is your city that you're familiar with. Not quite the same when you go somewhere else, but if you're familiar with it, it becomes almost unseen, I suppose is the best way of putting it.
And so the seeking out here is to reinscribe yourself perhaps in the city if you were feeling distanced from it. And also then to kind of go back what we were saying before, the cartographic product in quotes, sort of whether it's a sort of mashup or cut up of the a city published map, this is the psychogeographer holding that up to the mirror and saying, look, this is what you could be. Is that the response from the psychogeographer, like holding up that map, so to speak, and saying, well, look, the city is also this?
Yes, that's what they're doing, but they're also saying this alternative city is only mine. Yours could be different. So they are saying that.
So it's not offering up it's not trying to come up with another dominant way of thinking about the city. No.
Yeah. No, it's trying to say there are so many possibilities. Mm. There are so many possibilities. Your city is different from my city, but they're all not this one. They're still all not this one. You know, this is
right.
Just one, and this is the one that power structures, those in power, want us to believe it is, but actually it's not. It's what you want it to be. So it's utopian in that sense, you know.
And embracing multiple realities, embracing multiple time spaces, and and really challenging that dominant representation of that place, of Paris or of London or Leeds or Salzburg. Austria.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
You are listening to Geographical Imaginations, where each month we venture into the geographies of everything and nothing. For more information about the show, check out the website at www.geographicalimaginations.org. Now let's get back to our episode. You've been instrumental in the creation of the Leeds. So Leeds, I'm talking in England and the UK here, the Leeds Psychogeography Group. With the diverse sort of ideas or diverse practices, if we want to use that term, how do you come together as a group then? What's the common thread there between...
I set it up when I first became interested in psychogeography, so that was in 2009.
Uh-huh.
And I set it up because I couldn't find one that existed already in the area. And really, I created it to try and get disparate people together that could come together through a common interest in psychogeography, even though they maybe weren't psychogeographers. So I set it up as a kind of a research group, And once a fortnight, I had a speaker in term time. I had a speaker who could be talking about anything that was related to psychogeography. So they weren't necessarily psychogeographers. They might be or they might not be, but they would be talking about something that psychogeographers would be interested in. So they could be talking about public art. They could be talking about a particular interest they had in kind of landscape, writing about landscape, or even painting or drawing landscape. They could be interested in films, sort of psychogeographically oriented films, like the films of Patrick Keeler, for instance. So it was really broad in terms of the speakers I had. And the interesting thing about that was that it meant that there was a core group of people who attended who either were psychogeographers or became psychogeographers through the group. And then there were other people who kind of dipped in and out when the talk was something they were interested in.
Yeah.
So it was kind of a sort of a core group of people and then a fluid group of people, because it was open to the university academics and students, but also it was open to anybody outside of the university. That was one of the things I was trying to do, was to sort of reach out to kind of local Leeds people who are interested in kind of history or literature or other things. And kind of bring them into the university and enable them to sort of be part of the group, really. So the speakers were somewhat academics. I would say probably maybe half of the speakers in the time around it, which was 4 years, were academics, and the other half weren't. They were artists or people who were, urban photographers. And then we also had, like, maybe two or three walks a year as well.
Okay. Yeah. What did you do on the walks? What kind of walks would you do?
Well, mostly Tim Waters, who ran the group with me, he was the one who did the walks mostly.
Uh-huh.
We had an annual walk called Beating the Bounds, which is an old-fashioned type of kind of walking that we kind of made into a contemporary thing.
Uh-huh.
And Beating the Bounds is something that villagers used to do with the young sort of children in the village, to make sure they didn't go outside the village boundary. I don't know what century we're talking about, by the way, because I forget now. But so they used to take the children to the edge of the village, and if they stepped over the boundary, they'd beat them to make sure they didn't go into outside of the boundary of the village. So we did a kind of a mock version of this, and we used to walk a particular route we chose. And then we'd kind of pretend to do little kind of like gestures of beating the youngest person in the group, and do little kind of performances around this particular route that we chose, which could be just a small area in Leeds or something like that. So we'd do that. That was a kind of performative thing that we did once a year. And then we'd have, like, I did an owl walk 1 year. Owls are a symbol of Leeds, going back a long time, and there are owls all over, statues of owls all over Leeds. So I took everybody on a walk to see all the owl statues and all the owl symbols and that kind of thing. So, so we did it like two or three of those a year, and then I stopped running it in 2013. It still exists as a kind of digital space, so we have a Facebook page,
right,
and a mailing list and that kind of thing, and occasional walks still, but I don't run it as a research group anymore.
In terms of, like, the network, I know in the UK, I think psychogeography probably is much more alive than, I'm coming from the East Coast of the United States. I've actually been to a psychogeography conference. It's called Conflux. I don't know if it still goes anymore in New York, but it did run for a few years. And I maybe caught maybe the second to last or last of their conferences. Is that a way the various groups across? I mean, you talked before about sort of, there's this London psychogeographer identity, I'm sure there are members of clubs there, or groups, or are you coming together at conferences every year or something?
We do come together at conferences. There is a little bit of a sort of north-south divide, by the way, which I kind of make more of than it really is, in a sort of jokey kind of way. There's the there's the London psychogeographers, and then there's the rest of us. I
oh,
kind
right.
of like to joke that they're in their kind of core place, and then there's the rest of us. We're sort of like a nebulous group, but we've kind of got a joke that we say is we're the Northern psychogeographers. We sort of say that, but we do it in a sort of ironic way, really.
Yeah.
So we do come together. Like about, I think it was 3 years ago, there was a Situationist conference in Brighton. And that brought people from all around the country, obviously, including Mackenzie Walk, who's, I forget what university he's at in New York, one of the leading writers on the Situationist. He was there as well. So that did
right.
bring us together. And we did recently have a conference in Huddersfield as well, which brought lots of people in the region together, and even actually some people from... Utrecht came over especially for the conference, so
right.
That was really sort of a northern based thing, but that included sort of people from Leeds, who were originally part of the Leeds Psychogeography Group, the Huddersfield Psychogeography Network, and people some people came over from Manchester as well. So it was mostly representing the kind of the north of England as well.
And are walks a big part of a conference, and then people giving presentations? Are people going out and doing workshops, kind of thing?
Well, there were actually the Situationist one I went to. No, I don't think anyone did that. But the Huddersfield conference, which was in September, it was, I would say, 2/3 of it was walks and 1/3 was talks. So that was fantastic. So that was more like Conflux, which you've been to.
Right.
So there's loads of activities and walks and workshops, which is really ultimately what psychogeography is about. You know, I'm originally a cultural theorist, so I do tend to like theorising about things. But one of the reasons I went into psychogeography is because I was sort of a bit sick of just talking about stuff and not doing anything that was kind of practice-based, and psychogeography enabled me to do that.
Yeah.
So I do find it a shame when there's not enough of those kinds of events when psychogeography does appear, because that is what psychogeography is about. It's not about talking about it. It's about doing it. You know, that's ultimately what it's about. That's how you understand it. You understand it by doing it. You don't understand it by reading it.
Right.
Ultimately, you have to kind of get a pair of comfortable shoes on and get out there and walk, you know. Even if it's in your neighbourhood, that's what you have to do to really understand what it's about and to see the space in a different way.
You're listening to Geographical Imaginations. Geographical Imaginations is a growing multimedia public geography initiative designed to bring academic and everyday geographical thinking together. We believe everybody is a geographer and a co-maker of spaces. As an inquiry-based project, we ask questions and explore themes through dialogues with different texts and voices. Inevitably, our explorations return to simple yet complex questions, like how does blank inform the way I picture the world in my head? And how does that picture in turn limit or expand my place in the world? The main focus of the project is this hour-long radio essay program, or radio essay expedition, that's broadcast monthly from Radio Fabrique in Salzburg, Austria. In each episode, we make brief expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. We reflect upon our relationships with the worlds we inhabit and co-create. While many of the episodes deal with local and regional topics, themes are somewhat universal, and our investigations could inform the geographical imaginations of those living anywhere in the world. Now let's get back to our episode. Do you consider yourself a psychogeographer?
I do consider myself a psychogeographer, but originally I'm a kind of cultural theorist. But I do practice-based work, and I do theory-based work as well, because as an academic, I have to be able to kind of theorise what I've done on some level. So,
right.
So I do call myself a psychogeographer. Yeah.
Yeah. What kinds of things do you do? I mean, you mentioned some of the other things that other people are interested in, these deep topography or deep mapping kind of practices. What is the walk part of what you do, or?
Yes, the walk is part of it, or exploring, kind of physically exploring the space itself. But my particular interest is in how power structures are manifest in space through not necessarily obvious ways. For example, if you went to the city of London, it would be quite apparent how power manifests itself by looking at the large buildings, for example, in the Docklands or parts of in the area of what's called the City Mile. That they're kind of more obvious manifestations of power, but they can be subtly manifest, and sometimes you have to seek them out to be able to see them. And what I'm interested in is how power affects the lives of people historically very often. So I like to find out how social history might be kind of hidden in the landscape somewhere. So that's kind of what I tend to look for. And recently I did a project at an area on the University of Leeds campus that is actually a parkland space now, but it used to be a cemetery. So I've done sort of psychogeography in that area in order to be able to find out about the history of the space itself, the social history. So you have to kind of really literally have to take yourself there to explore. You don't necessarily know about the history of a place by just reading about it. You do sometimes have to take yourself there to find out that things might not be how they appear. You know, you have to look a bit more closely at the terrain itself. And then you find little clues, and when you start doing research, those clues that you've seen in the terrain will lead you somewhere else, and then you'll start to unpeel the kind of layers of the space and find out what's actually gone on historically.
One of the things at the show here with Geographical Imaginations, I think part of the ideas is we're exploring these different topics and also, I think, in some ways, exploring different methods or methodologies to get to better understand, I think, our relationship with a space, with a place, and we kind of tried to talk about those two terms and how they might be interpreted in different ways. And just consider some of these different concepts and consider maybe a different kind of engagement with either the town or city that we live in. And by maybe trying different things. And so we've talked about just going out and mapping and go out and map your neighborhood. And what would that even look like? And that was one of the kind of workshops, idea type things that we've had. Another has been using this concept of rhythm analysis and trying to think, does our town actually have a rhythm? And what are the things that go into that? I guess here we are, we're talking about psychogeography. What might be some things, you know, if... whether or not maybe you do a workshop, what are some things that you might discuss with a workshop or, you know, for the listener here from Salzburg or beyond, you know, what are some of the things that they might be able to do? I mean, what does it mean, I guess, to be doing psychogeography, and where does one sort of start?
One good example of how to sort of begin is the one I mentioned earlier with the situation, is where they kind of drew an outline of a city and then mapped that over their own city and walked around that line. That's quite a nice one to do.
Yeah.
You can make it whatever size you like. You know, you are in control of sort of creating the route how you want to, but you kind of want to make it chance. And we've done things like dice walking, which is a really good one, especially, for example, if you've got numbers on a map, like we did one on the campus once, and all because all the buildings were numbered because of the index, you know, the key for the map, so we could use the dice to walk on there. Although you could obviously break the map up into sections and number them anyway, and then use a dice, so you can, if the numbers aren't on the map, you can create numbers on the map, you could make a matrix and number them, and then use a dice, and then you just go walk to that space if you can, sometimes in as straight a line as you possibly can to get to that space, and then that becomes interesting because you get to a wall, and do you climb the wall, do you go round the wall, and then you have to make a decision when you get to that space, do we go left or right, do we decide between us, you know, all those kind of things you have to kind of negotiate on the way around, which makes it interesting.
Right.
But one of the ones that I found the easiest to do, and this is this is one of the probably most interesting ones. It doesn't require any planning, any maps or anything, and it's literally you go left, left, right. So you go left, left, right, left, left, right, left, and you just keep repeating that. And that's all you have to think about. You don't have to carry a map with you. I mean, you might want to in case you get lost. And that's it. That's all the information you need. And then you'll be going in a way that you don't know. You'll automatically be going. And sometimes you get to and you can't go left again. So you think, oh, what am I going to do here? We'll have to do something else. So it's also part of if you're with other people and negotiating what you do when things aren't that clear. So you can you can even have a backup plan that you might do something else when you get stuck. What we'll do is we'll toss a dice and then we'll go left or right sort of thing.
Right.
So, but that's the easiest one, and actually it turns out to be quite an interesting one, the left, left, right one. It doesn't require any planning, just requires you on your own or with a group of people, and then you're off. You're off immediately with no planning, so...
So if you're in a sort of a highly urbanized area where left, left, and right happen kind of quickly,
yes,
and where they happen quickly, so for one thing, you're breaking out of the routine of your normal paths that you take through that city space, whether that's to and from work or school, or to the, you know, the restaurant or the cafe that you like the best. So you're immediately sort of thrown out of the routinized pathways or trajectories, and that does that open your eyes to then another part of the city?
Yeah, it does. And well, one of the interesting things about doing that is that you see what is happening behind the veneer of the city.
Yeah.
So, 'cause you end up in little alleyways, you end up in places where people keep their bins, you know, like offices keep their bins. And, you know, all sorts of places you would never go to. Sometimes they're a bit smelly, they can be dirty, and sometimes you get stuck, and all sorts of things. You think, oh, well, we'll have to go back the way we came. But you will absolutely see your city in a different way, absolutely, for sure. It will, it will take you to quite often the sort of the behind the scenes of your city, which is the real city, you know, not the one, not the spectacle, not the high street where all the shops are. It's the little alleyways in between the shops. That's where you want to go as a psychogeographer. You know, we don't want to see the shop fronts as psychogeographers. We want to go down the alleyway and see if that takes us somewhere, and then you find something really interesting. You know, it's like, it's just exciting because you don't know what you're going to find.
Yeah.
And you will inevitably find something interesting without question. You'll find something that looks interesting, or you'll find a little bit of history hidden there. Or all sorts of, you can't anticipate what you're going to find. That's the whole point of it. You can't, you never know what you're going to find, really.
So right, so kind of cutting through the, I don't know, the grid that you have of your own city, because we all have our own sort of grid. I mean, there's obviously the physical grid of the city, but we all have our own pathways that we're taking, and you're basically cutting through that too. Your own, as well as the city's, and by going into those alleyways and smelling perhaps the bad the bad smelling alleyways, but that's part of it. That's part of it.
And there was an academic, she's no longer with us, called Victoria Henshaw, and she does something. She used to do something called smell walks.
Yeah.
And she was a psychogeographer. I met her very early on when I was involved in psychogeography, and she came to talk to Lee's psychogeography group, and that was her. That was her area, and she was originally an urban planner and then became an academic, And that was her field. Within psychogeography, her field was
smell.
So sense walking is a sort of separate field in its own right anyway.
Right.
Some people kind of connect it to psychogeography. I would connect it to psychogeography, but some people might connect it to other fields as well.
Yeah.
There are other psychogeographers who do things like kind of silent walk. So you walk in like a crocodile, a long line, and you don't speak. So you literally just listen to the environment as well, whether it's birds chirping or trucks reversing. And you notice those.
Yeah.
Because it is easy, you know, we're very visual, you know, humans are very visually oriented. It's very easy to see the city. It's not so easy to hear it or smell it or touch it.
Yeah.
You know, but they're all valid ways of connecting to our city in a very, very real physiological way, you know.
Right. Yeah, so it's not just changing what you're seeing. It's not just trying to see this other aspect and other the so-called alleyways of the city, the underground, not so much even the underground, but just the places that you don't normally see. It's also using different senses and privileging the other sense, because like you say, we are so visual. Why not smell the city? Why not follow the smells that sort of capture our imagination and try and track down where they're coming from? Like, that sort of thing is also then shifting, I guess, that shifts our the which sense we're giving more, you know, that we're privileging, that we're giving more importance to at the time, because we do follow the city with our eyes, but if we were to use a different sense, it opens up this other layer too, right?
Yes, yeah. Yes, that's exactly right. And also, I mean, the you know, the flaneurs of Paris at the turn of the 20th century, they had ways of walking in a different way. So they would, there was, I forget which flaneur it was now, but there was one who had a tortoise on a lead, and so he'd walk really, really slowly through the arcades in Paris.
Yeah.
Because he had no choice, you know. So that's another experience as well. It would be changing your speed of walking.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And doing what, you know, there are lots of different things you could do. You could one of the things that we used to do, we've done before now, is at particular points where we've stopped, is we've turned around and taken a photograph of where we've come from rather than where we're going to. It's so automatic to take a photograph of where you're heading or where you're looking, but we've like tried to take a photograph of where we've come from rather than where we're sort of going.
Yeah.
So we've tried to do a few things like that as well, you know, and attach them to like a GPS map. So we've tried to do other little quirky things as well, little add-ons as well, to make it a bit different, because I think those are all things that once you kind of start on this sort of journey into psychogeography, you can sort of tailor it in whatever way you like, and do extra little kind of quirky things as well,
right?
To make it fun or interesting or different, which is one of the nice things about it. And then if you're in a group of people, then everyone's got different ideas as well, which makes it more interesting. You're sort of a little bit limited on your own,
yeah.
to just your own ideas and your own subjectivity. It's kind of nice to be in a group and say and compare notes with other people and compare ideas as well. So
it is quite different, the individual versus the collective experience of
it's
doing
complete,
this.
It's yeah. almost like a different thing entirely.
Yeah.
I find them both enjoyable, but they're completely different.
Yeah.
It's a completely different experience, really. It's very solitary, especially when you're aware that you're behaving differently in a particular space. Because as a psychogeographer, you don't, you know, when you're on your own, or with other people, you don't necessarily behave like a regular pedestrian does. That's not so problematic when you're in a group, but when you're on your own, you're a bit more self-conscious about going down an alleyway or looking like you're stopping on a pavement and gazing at a manhole cover.
Yeah.
Or I don't know if you call them manhole covers in America.
Sure.
But is that what they call the covers that you have
uh-huh.
over
yeah.
utilities? Yeah. Manhole covers. So, you know, those kind of things, if you saw someone doing that on the street, you'd think, what's wrong with them? So you're kind of, you do become a bit more self-conscious as a psychogeographer on your own.
Right.
So it's a different experience. It's still excellent, but just different.
Yeah. In terms of, I guess, you're talking about taking pictures too. How do people document these urban walks or just in general psychogeography. But how about specifically like the urban walks? Is it photographs? Is it the sort of mashing up maps? What other ways can you actually, you know, document and say, well, this is, you know, this is what I'm doing, kind of a thing?
Well, we've done all the above before, but some people do recordings of sounds as well.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, with GPS now, you can do fantastic things. You know, if you have taken photographs, you can attach those to your GPS map and those kinds of things. So when you open it, you can click on a little, you know, camera symbol and it will show you a photograph. So all those kinds of things. I mean, I've had a period of creating maps. I did quite a few maps myself for a while. Although I, you know, don't consider myself to be a cartographer, but I have created some, and I tend to like to do the kind of reappropriate maps that already exist. So I've created maps that look like the Situationist maps, but they're actually my own maps.
Right.
People do all sorts of things. They cut maps up. A lot of people tend to do. It tends to be generally text with photos attached, though, because lots of psychographers. Have their own blogs, so it's easy to put images and text in. So I would say that's the most common way is to have text and images on blogs.
You're listening to Geographical Imaginations, radio expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. For more information about the show, check out the website at www.geographicalimaginations.org. Do you have an idea for an episode or want to give some feedback? Go to the comments section on the website or to the blog and enter into the conversation. Now let's get back to our expedition. So here on the show doing our public geography, can't help but think about public psychogeography. And tonight's episode is really about that, about bringing sort of academic thinking and psychogeographical practices, someone who's doing psychogeography and discussing it here in the format on our show. So many times we do have these dialogues with people that are working in the field that really know the topics we're talking about from the inside and from the outside, theoretically, but also as practitioners. And so if you are interested in more about Tina Richardson's work, I would check out her website, www.schizocartography, so schizocartography.co.uk, to read more about her work, and it has links to her blog and other projects. So check that out. I am also wanting, as we're talking here about public geography, the idea here is to engage the audience and maybe here engage the audience in a psychogeographical mini expedition or expedition. And we want to take some of Tina Richardson's ideas a little bit and some of the things maybe we at the Geographical Imaginations have done in the past and try that here in Salzburg. And so in the past, we've taken the Asunción, Paraguay marathon route, the line that's created that by that route, and literally taking off of Asunción and transposing that line that's made by the interaction between the city grid and a 26.2 mile or 42 kilometer long route, and the decision making that goes into where that route's going to go. But taking that line, transposing it, we did this in Madrid 3 years ago, and now want to revisit that idea here in Salzburg. So we'll be taking the Asunción Paraguay marathon route, transposing it onto 2016 Salzburg, Austria, and walking it, actually, which is another kind of, we're not actually going to run, but we're going to walk it and then document that a little bit. So check out the blog section as we move forward here on the website at www.geographicalimaginations.org for dates and times of this walk. Probably be on a weekend, but contact me if you're interested. This brings us to the end of another radio expedition. Follow us on Facebook or visit the website for more information and look to see how you can participate and get involved. I want to thank Tina Richardson for all of her insights and for taking the time to share her experiences with us. And all of the guests volunteer their time, and here at the show, we're always grateful. I also want to thank Mike Allen for letting us use this song here, Sand Dune, from his album Gamma. Check out all of his work on his website, barefootsongsmith.bandcamp.com. Thanks for joining us again. See you next month. Ciao.